Welcome to Two Beers In, the Government Affairs Institute podcast on understanding Congress. My name is Laura Blessing. I'm a senior fellow at GAI, and I'm here today to wrap up the entire year and appropriations and lots of crazy, crazy things with one of our favorite reporters here at GAI. Jen Schutt is the Washington senior reporter for States Newsroom, formerly of CQ Roll Call. States Newsroom is a nonprofit newsroom in most states and DC, and I'm really happy to have her here with us today to demystify this process and understand, you know, what's normal, what's abnormal, and what to look for going forward. So warm welcome to you, Jen.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back on the podcast.
So let's kick off by talking about a couple of different things. We've got the appropriations cycle. We've got some supplemental emergency spending. We've got the NDAA. Chalk up a win for Congress. Woot woot. Going to take the W where we can, as well as like maybe do a little bit of a roundup of both the unprecedented and unusual this particular year. So let's kick things off with appropriations. How did we get here?
We got here the same way we get here every year, with a few sort of tweaks here and there, right? And Congress is supposed to pass all 12 of the annual appropriations bills by October 1st, which is the start of the fiscal year. And pretty much every year since 1996, Congress has reached that deadline without completing work on all of its appropriations measures to fund the government. And every sort of year when they come back from that August recess in September, they sort of fake surprise and say, oh, we can't believe we didn't get the work done this year. Shocking. We're going to have to do a stopgap spending bill and then try to wrap it up in mid-December. But the big difference this year is that Speaker Mike Johnson and House Republicans really did not want to deal with that mid-December wrap up, sort of end of the year omnibus spending package. And so they did what they refer to as a laddered CR. And so that means that four of the appropriations bills are supposed to get done by January 19th, and the remaining eight are supposed to get done by February 2nd. But because Congress can really only govern at the last minute and in sort of a flurry of panic, they don't actually have an agreement on the total spending level for the current fiscal year, which began back on October 1st, or an agreement between the House and Senate on how to divide up that total spending level for defense and non-defense discretionary spending into the 12 appropriations bills. And so they are way behind schedule. And so now everyone is talking about sort of the January crush.
This is such a great kind of big picture overview. Thank you for that. And I'm clutching my pearls over here, realizing that they might not be doing things on time.
Shocking.
I know.
Really unpredictable for this bunch.
Yeah, I hope everyone listening to us at home is sitting down. And you know, we've seen such big kind of historical appropriations dysfunction for a long time. You know, I tend to, you know, while this has always been a difficult process, I tend to think of like roughly 2010 and afterwards as seeing, you know, particularly notable breakdown. We haven't passed an individual appropriations bill into law, which is how it's supposed to happen, in a little over a decade. We're not passing budget resolutions unless we've got unified party government. So all these different parts of the stages have really broken down, and you've done a nice job of describing what's kind of typical these days, that we get into this end of the fiscal year spending crunch, and then we kick the can down the road a little bit with at least one CR, often a series of them. I'd like to, so kind of within that larger context, I want to dive into, you know, this year just a little bit, because, you know, we were talking earlier and you said, gosh, you know, like some of this stuff, it's familiar, but some of it's different. And let's kind of suss that out a little bit. So first of all, we had an agreement over the debt ceiling that has really kind of structured the appropriations fights going forward. Can you just tell us a little bit about that and how to understand, and how normal is that?
Yeah, and so Congress obviously has to deal with the debt ceiling every couple years, depending on how they structured the previous suspension or raise of the debt limit. And so they needed to do that earlier this year. And after a lot of sort of tense comments between who was then Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, and the Biden administration, they got together. House Republicans were led by Congressman Graves and Congressman McHenry, and the White House was predominantly led by OMB Director Shalonda Young. And so they negotiated this debt limit deal, which typically is separate from the annual appropriations process, the debt limit, and how that, you know, works to allow the federal government to borrow money to pay all of its bills in full and on time is not really part of the annual appropriations process. But what they decided to do this year is put the total spending levels for the 12 annual appropriations bills in that debt limit deal for the current fiscal year, which is fiscal 24, and then next fiscal year, which is fiscal 25. And so I personally thought that was pretty good news. This became law. This was sort of negotiated in late May and it became law in early June. And so I thought, oh, this is actually pretty good news for the appropriations process. They probably won't get all 12 bills done by October 1st because that would be, you know, lunacy to try to do anything on deadline in Congress. But, you know, that sort of to me indicated that, okay, the House can now do its 12 bills. The Senate can do their 12 bills. Sometime around, you know, mid-October, they'll probably start conferencing those. They have agreed upon top lines. That's really one of the harder parts of this process. And then you just kind of let appropriators do their thing for a few months, obviously with a lot of the heavy lifting being done by staff, like it always is with Congress. And then like, we'll probably get some minibuses in early and mid-December. But of course, that is not what happened. The House Appropriations Committee wrote its bills significantly below those funding levels by, you know, dozens of billions of dollars, depending on what set of numbers you use. It can be a little bit different because the math is always not really math when it comes to the appropriations process. And they, you know, the House Appropriations Committee, sort of the Republicans are in the majority there. So they added in a lot of these sort of policy provisions that their members really want to see accomplished, which when you don't do standalone legislation, ends up thrown into the appropriations bills, which makes the process that much more complicated. And so the House Appropriations Committee was able to report out 10 of its bills. The House was able to pass 7 of those across the floor, some of which hit several speed bumps along the way, including defense appropriations, which I believe was pulled 3 times before it was able to pass. But those bills aren't written to the top lines in that spending deal, and that makes it really complicated to try to conference with the Senate, which more or less wrote their spending bills to those top line numbers, and all 12 of which were reported out of committee with broad bipartisan votes.
Okay. All right. So we've got the inclusion of the debt ceiling, which, you know, does not, you know, while we've seen, you know, a level of partisanship and peril in this since 2011 that we haven't seen previously, is certainly not a typical part of our yearly process. We've seen a, you know, big summit, you know, kind of agreement on top line spending, which is not unusual. You know, after the Budget Control Act of 2011, you had a series of different agreements to, you know, nail down top line numbers for a while. But then we had people backing off of those numbers after the agreement. So that's new, and that's hard. And they're still, and they still disagree, even as we're going into the late part of December here. I wanted to get into some more appropriations aspects that you've touched on a little bit, you know, both, you know, some of the different provisions that have gotten attached to these individual appropriations bills. You know, to understand, you know, how typical this is and how we should think about this going forward, because we've had a lot of different socially conservative provisions get attached, many of which include abortion. We've seen abortion provisions included in virtually all of the spending bills. And that has changed the dynamic that we've seen here. I was wondering if you could, you know, kind of tell us a little bit about this and how that changes the politics for different appropriations committees. How are different appropriations, you know, subcommittees, levels of partisanship affected by these different provisions being attached?
Yeah, of course. So one of the things that we do typically see with these appropriations measures, especially in the House, not necessarily in the Senate so much, but really these sort of House bills, is that anything the leadership, whether it be Democrats or Republicans, don't plan on bringing to the floor as standalone bills or as part of another package, they sort of just kind of throw that at the appropriators and say, hey, you know, Congressperson so-and-so is asking for this and we don't think it can pass on the floor as a standalone, so can you like roll it up in a bill somewhere? And then there's all these sort of bigger picture issues that the parties, sort of at their core and their governing philosophies, believe are instrumental to democracy or to the best version of America that they want to see moving forward. And so, because so many other committees and sort of authorizing legislation doesn't really get a whole lot of attention in the modern Congress, so many of these issues end up falling to the Appropriations Committee. And that's something we have typically seen in the past. But every year, regardless of whether or not Democrats or Republicans are in control of the committee, there's something new that's happening, right? And one of the things this year is if you track reproductive rights and abortion access at all, you know there's this case out of Texas with respect to when and how people should be able to get a prescription for what's sort of known as the abortion pill or mifepristone. And so right now, this is a pharmaceutical that the FDA originally approved in 2000. They made changes to its prescribing and dosage in 2016, and then during the COVID-19 pandemic as well. And so there's this lawsuit that is sort of one challenging the original 2000 approval of mifepristone, which was 23 years ago, give or take some months, as well as the changes that the FDA made during the past decade in 2016 and 2021, and then I believe in 2022 as well. And so that case is working itself out in the judiciary, right? Like a US federal district court gave a ruling, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans gave a ruling, the Supreme Court said earlier this month that they are going to take up that issue next this session. So we'll get a ruling on that by July. But because lawmakers don't like to leave things to the judiciary or the executive branch or the states most of the time, all of those politics have gotten rolled up in these appropriations bills, one of which is the agriculture appropriations bill, which, based on its title, you would think, well, what the heck? How is this possible? But the FDA is funded in the annual agriculture appropriations bill. And that is one of the ones that has gotten really thorny for House Republicans because they were trying to say that the FDA should not have made all these changes and roll some of them back in that legislation. So typically, this has been sort of restricted to the labor, HHS, and education bill, but this year it's really throughout the bills because abortion politics, following the Supreme Court's decision in the Dobbs case to return the issue of abortion access to the people and their elected representatives. It's really Congress has really started trying to take a more active role in this, but not in signaling legislation on the floor, really, more through these policy riders and these appropriations bills. And so that's one of dozens of issues that's come up, which is sort of new, but also sort of standard for this process.
That's such a great description. So, these use of these different insertion of different abortion related and they're related in many different ways provisions into different appropriations bills really is a new thing. To be sure, we've historically had the Hyde and Weldon amendments in the Labor H bill as well as the Helms Amendment in state and foreign ops. So it's not like we haven't had these abortion provisions and appropriations bills over time, but just the number of them and the number of bills that they're touching is really unusual. Just for a little bit of context, can you tell us how would you normally characterize the politics of the agriculture appropriations bill, for example?
Yeah, none of the appropriations bills are exempt from politics, right? Like if you look at the jurisdiction list, there's 12 appropriations bills, but they fund roughly a third of the federal government's budget every year. And so they all sort of have issues in them, right? Like if you think of commerce, justice, science, there's a lot of Republican frustration right now with how the Justice Department is being sort of run under the Biden administration. So all of those issues, if you can't address them in other means, fall to that CJS appropriations bills. And the same thing is true of any bill that has funding for a federal program that may become political at some point. And so the one you just brought up is really sort of a great case study from the last few years, the Hyde Amendment, the Helms Amendment, and Weldon. They all more or less say no federal money will go to abortion access with limited exceptions. And those three have broadly been defined over the decades they've existed as, rape, incest, or the life of the patient, the pregnant patient. And so when Democrats were in control of the House and the Senate and the White House, during the first 2 years of the Biden administration for the first time since those amendments were added to these appropriations bills decades ago. Democrat chairs in the House and Senate. In the House, it was Chair Rosa DeLauro. In the Senate, it was Patrick Leahy. They removed Hyde. So essentially what that would have done would allow the federal government to pay for abortions outside of those three exceptions. But obviously, because in general, when the conference bills get done, those final bills that become law, you have to get rid of any new policy riders. And so that meant that those provisions went back in the final bills, even though Democrats had control of the House, Senate, and the White House. So if we're thinking about what House Republicans have tried to do with the dozen annual appropriations bills in their chamber, in their committee this year, the odds are if they conference out final appropriations bills with the Senate and the Biden administration, we're going to be able to look to that case study of what Democrats tried to do with Hyde and what it ended up actually being in the final bills that become law. That is probably going to be status quo for all these changes that House Republicans have tried to make to policy language in the fiscal 24 appropriations bills. But that's far from a guarantee, because the politics of the House Republicans, as we've all seen throughout the year, is sort of like a roller coaster that like is being built in real time. And so especially with a speaker like Mike Johnson, who's really hitting that learning curve and trying to step up the leadership office of the House after being sort of a relatively obscure Republican for so many years. There's a lot of new dynamics here at play. And so everything that we've learned from past appropriations processes, and even though, you know, Kay Granger and all of the subcommittee chairs in the House are really seasoned Republicans at this, the politics of the party, especially heading into a presidential election year, is going to complicate things. And the fact they pushed it till January, when we're going to have the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary for Republicans, might make things that much harder on them to get these full year bills agreed to with the Senate and enacted into law.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love this. I love your description of, you know, building the roller coaster while they're riding it. That's perfect. And you know, I think agriculture is such a great case study. It is, you know, traditionally one of the easiest lifts. It's so bipartisan. That's true of the, you know, appropriations subcommittee. And that's also certainly true of the authorizing committees as well. You know, I remember taking some GAI students to the Senate agriculture committee room. You know, their staff was really lovely. They support our educational mission. And for the committee table, it's not the typical dais that you have. It's actually just a big long table, and they sit on either side of it and hammer things out. And the way that they describe that to my students is, you know, well, farmers, they hammer things out at their kitchen tables, and we do the same thing here at agriculture. And I thought it was such a, you know, such a lovely description of the bipartisanship of the committee, as well as kind of the way that they see themselves. And, you know, certainly with agriculture, you know, which is still, you know, not passed through the House. you know, that's really a very large deviation from the typical politics that we see there. And let me change gears just a little bit to highlight another aspect of the appropriations process. We've had earmarks come back for a short time now. Rosa DeLauro, you know, famously brought him back when the Democrats were in charge. And so we've seen a Democratic cycle. Now we're seeing a Republican cycle. And actually, actually agriculture is one of the bills that has attracted a lot of earmarks on it. Now, we've seen just, you know, in your earlier statement, gosh, some of this is new, and some of this is expected, and some of this is unexpected. How should we think about the use of earmarks in this Congress? And yeah, let me not give you like a five-part question. How should we think about how they're using earmarks as Congress?
Yeah, and so earmarks under unified Democratic control of Congress were broadly bipartisan, right? And so if you think back to the beginning of the Biden administration, there had been a lot of conversations for a couple of years about bringing these back, and you did have sort of this broad coalition of Democratic and Republican lawmakers who said, you know, the Constitution gives Congress the power of the purse. We are supposed to have the authority to determine when and how the federal government spends money. That's ours. And so a lot of these lawmakers who supported earmarks, which you are probably hearing referred to now as community project funding or congressionally directed spending, they've been rebranded as part of this relaunch. They sort of said that in just saying, here, Army Corps of Engineers, you get X dollars this year, figure it out, that that Congress and the legislative branch had ceded some of its constitutional authority over spending to the executive branch, which is sort of where all these federal departments and agencies that get federal funding exist in that sort of federal government structure. And so the proponents of earmarking who wanted to bring it back, who were Democrats and Republicans alike, sort of made that argument. There's a lot of people who are opposed to earmarks who said, you know, no matter how many new transparency mechanisms and guardrails you place on this, it's still going to be a place of potential misuse of federal funds and power brokering and backroom deals and all these things that they don't want to see Congress return to. And so when these got brought back, Rosa DeLauro, who was chair of the House Appropriations Committee at the time and chair of Senate Appropriations Committee, Pat Leahy, put new transparency mechanisms and guardrails in place. And like the Government Accountability Office audits these every year and puts out a public report that people can go read. And so there's all these new things. And so the process went really well. And actually, I did an article when I was still at CQ Roll Call, completely covering the budget appropriations process, was my entire existence in that job. And I did an article interviewing a lot of Republicans in the House and Senate about how they thought that process went in its first fiscal year. And all of them were sort of like, yeah, the split of money works. We're pretty okay with it. You know, the new sort of mechanisms and when and how you can earmark and specific accounts within the appropriations bills that you can earmark, that all seems to be working well. But we have seen in the House, not the Senate, the Senate is still doing okay with their earmarks, according to Democrats and Republicans. All the senators who wanted to participate are pretty happy with the process in the Senate. The House process, however, has become political. Democrats, predominantly through who Rosa DeLauro, who is now ranking member of the House Appropriations Committee, raised a lot of frustrations with how Republicans had handled this process this year in terms of total earmark spending, which is less than 1% of discretionary spending based on those guardrails. They have said that how that funding is broken down between Democratic projects and Republican projects is not necessarily equitable or fair in their terminology. Republicans have rejected this and said, hey, when you were in charge, you got roughly this percentage and we got roughly this percentage. We just flipped that. So it's fair as far as we're concerned. Democrats have said in the House that because they had so many more Democrats requesting so many more projects, that that's not in their view fair. So that debate has been going on behind the scenes in this, well, not behind the scenes, but sort of along with all the other debates this year, obviously in public view because the markups are public. And then another place where in the House Appropriations Committee, earmarks have gotten really political is that in one of the spending bills, if I'm remembering correctly, is the Transportation HUD spending bill. Originally in that appropriations measure, House Republicans included three projects that were broadly for LGBTQ community centers. And then the one Massachusetts project, if I'm remembering correctly, was for like a senior housing facility for LGBTQ people. And so the House Republicans approved those earmarks and put them in the original text of that appropriations measure. And then when we were in the committee markup, they actually moved to remove those three projects from that bill. And that became, that debate in that committee became very heated. Congressman Pocan, he had some very strong words for his Republican colleagues. If you sort of Google this, you can find the stories and the hearing. But so under Republican leadership in the House, this earmarking process has actually moved from what was sort of, you know, the wheels of government actually moving forward in a way that everyone sort of agreed was okay to a more partisan process because of those two things. And so I'm not entirely sure how that would get resolved moving forward or heading into next year's appropriations process.
Yeah, that's a really great description. I mean, I think with earmarks, to be fair to the Republicans, it's pretty typical for the minority party to get about a third of the earmarks, just historically. I think the Democrats have created a new standard with a percentage of those requesting earmarks. That being said, we've both seen the process of earmarking become more partisan, particularly with some of these socially conservative considerations for allowing earmarks that you just explained to our audience. But also, not only is it becoming partisan in ways that it, or caught up with different socially conservative politics, but it's also not bringing more people together. These folks, agriculture has gotten a ton of these. They've gotten a ton of earmarks, and yet it's still going nowhere, which used to be a major selling point for getting these. So I think we've, something I've said about earmarks for quite some time is that I'm, we've had all of these muscles of compromise be atrophied, and we need to have folks remember how to use those muscles again. And I'm not quite sure that we're there yet. But thank you for helping us understand, what's going on with earmarks this particular cycle. I think it's a really interesting development to continue to watch long term, especially as it's been subsumed by larger political and partisan forces. All right, so we've got, we had a shutdown scare, a new speaker, this whole laddered CR. I've got to ask you though, what was the kind of reaction of reporters, both yourself and as well as other folks that you knew, when they came out with this plan, which is not technically unprecedented. They did something similar in the Bush 41 administration, but it's certainly pretty unusual.
Yeah, the laddered CR approach is a little odd. And the sort of emphasis behind this was the idea was to make it easier to pass these appropriations bills, probably in a series of minibuses, if we're thinking about it practically and how it's actually going to play out. The odds of them passing all 12 one by one once they conference, which they haven't even begun doing yet, are pretty low. So I think a lot of us were thinking, well, okay, the goal with having four bills due by January 19th is you bundle all those bills together once you conference them and pass that minibus. And then during the following 2 weeks, heading into that February 2nd deadline for the remaining eight appropriations bills, you may package all those together or try two minibuses, one per week, something like that. And so we know that conservative House Republicans and a lot of Republicans in the Senate too, and even a pretty decent amount of Democrats really don't like omnibus spending measures. That's when they roll all 12 of the annual appropriations bills together in one legislative vehicle. So instead of getting vote to vote on separate packages or the bills themselves, you have to vote on everything at once, vote for it or against it. Those omnibuses also tend to attract a lot of unrelated items. You know, if you have a vulnerable member of your party who's really been trying to get a bill passed, that may get thrown in there. Tax policy fixes tend to get thrown in there. Leadership priorities that would never pass and standalone votes as their own bills get tossed in there too. It sort of becomes this mixing pot of like what random members want. And so the idea was to avoid that with this ladder CR. So the intention there was sort of a rational one. It's one where you sort of think, oh, okay, you know, this could work out, right? Because they don't really do well when they have all 12 bills up against a deadline. But that's not at all what we're seeing happen right now, right? Like, when they pass these stopgap spending bills, they're supposed to really put momentum behind getting that total spending level for defense and non-defense discretionary, breaking that down between the House and Senate on agreed upon spending levels for all 12 bills, and then letting the subcommittee chairs and ranking members in the House and Senate conference through legislation. No one's doing that. I mean, we've all been checking in with appropriators for weeks now, and several of us were just talking to Senate Ranking Member Susan Collins, a Republican of Maine, and she was saying they still don't have top lines. She's really concerned about the prospects of, you know, them getting into January and coming back the second week of January from this winter break and having leadership essentially throw up their hands and say, well, now we have to do a full year CR. And she and Senate Appropriations Chair Patty Murray and like every appropriator I've been talking to really wants to avoid that scenario. But even though they know these deadlines and these laddered deadlines, they don't really seem to be working towards a goal here the way that the rest of us have to work towards work deadlines. You know, you actually get to doing the work. Because you can't show up to a deadline and turn to your boss if you're a normal person and say, I knew I had this deadline. I knew it was technically October 1st, and then I knew it was mid-December. And I know you gave me another extension till mid-January, and then even another extension till early February. But I just like didn't feel like it, you know? I didn't really want to. So I'm not going to, right? Like that's not how the rest of us do this, right? You know, like your sort of example about agriculture earlier is great. Like if you're a farmer and you need to harvest by a certain date, you're doing the work leading up to that. You're not just sitting around watching football and, you know, I don't know, roasting a turkey or something. Like you're doing the work. But Congress is not currently doing the work, even though everybody on the committee says they want to. It's just not happening. And it's one of those things where we all, I mean, people like you and I who are just in this all day, every day are like, why on earth can't you just get it done? Like, you know, you have this deadline, you have it every year. Like, come on, guys, let's go.
Yeah, no, and I think that does a lot to foreshadow where we're going to be come January. Just given the lack of work that's gone on with this. Let's talk a little bit about some su supplemental emergency spending. We've seen, Ukraine emerge as a sticking point throughout the year. We've seen border security become a more re recent sticking point. Let's see, I think I've got a McConnell tends have quotes that don't always age very well. And I got a quote of his from the 1 year anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, with him identifying that, quote, too much attention is being given to very few people not invested in Ukraine's success. How do we understand where we are with this emergency? Security supplemental.
I think stuck is probably the best word to describe them. And it's really fascinating here because we're getting to watch McConnell, who is this really seasoned negotiator. I mean, he knows the short-term ramifications of legislation and the long-term ramifications of legislation because he's done this for so long, right? Like he and Schumer really know how to get a deal together. You could say the same thing about Biden. Like he's that classic deal-making senator. He's obviously president now, but you know, he was around that chamber and those two lawmakers for quite some time.
And
And so they
McConnell
know how to
and Biden
do
get all the
this.
credit in the world for not defaulting in 2011. These are those guys. Yeah, good description.
But the House, and especially House Republicans, are a completely different dynamic. Especially now that we have Mike Johnson of Louisiana as Speaker of the House, he's been very quickly staffing up the Speaker's office, but they're not at 100% yet, from my understanding of the situation. And he's also sort of being thrown into learning all these complicated processes and realize that the decisions he makes and the legislation he puts on the floor has global ramifications, right? Like, I think a lot of the time, you know, it's easy to joke that like Congress is a little bit like high school. And you know, there's like the popular kids and there's the nerds and there's the jocks. But I think, you know, when you're sort of not actually having this experience myself, but sort of thinking through what Johnson is probably going through now that he's a speaker, is he has all these internal, you know, political dynamics within House Republicans as a razor thin majority, especially with, you know, McCarthy sort of is gone now. He resigned, and another House Republican is going to be leaving. So, depending on the day, they really can only lose, you know, one or two Republicans and pass legislation on the floor. But he is sort of going through this process now of realizing that if the Senate gets to an agreement on immigration policy and this Ukraine and Israel aid package moves forward, he sort of has a lot of power in determining the outcome of world events, right? And this is one of those places where I think you move from being a person to being more the office. And this is one of those sort of theoretical conversations of like what Mike Johnson, as the congressman from Louisiana, wants, needs to sort of get put on a shelf. And what the Speaker of the House wants with respect to what's good for the United States and Western democracy needs to move to the forefront. And I think that's one of those things that I don't think a lot of us have good visibility into how often he's talking to McConnell or who he's getting advice from. But I think that's going to be one of the things that Johnson really has to face once the House comes back in 2024, especially if these Senate negotiators can get an agreement on changes to immigration and border policy, and the Senate can move this emergency spending package of roughly $110 billion forward. You know, he's going to have to wrestle with all this and figure out a way to move forward on this package. And that's going to be, I think, for him, a really significant test of leadership. And we're going to start to really learn more, not necessarily about Congressman Mike Johnson, but Speaker Mike Johnson and the type of governing he wants to see done in the House and the type of legacy he wants to leave behind. And all those things are bigger than who you are in your own district and your own policy beliefs. And I think that is going to be really fascinating, but it's all going to play out very quickly in January with these appropriations deadlines.
Yeah, that's a really nice description. And, you know, while there's been some noise of the negotiators on this supplemental package with emergency spending, you know, Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, plus border security starting to come back together. So you have some of the Senate negotiators starting to make some positive sounds. You know, the White House is identifying very clearly that Ukraine is running out of the money that we've sent them. They're at the absolute last dregs on this, and this is going to have to happen, you know, early next year, along with all the major appropriation stuff, which is difficult for Congress. I think your description of Mike Johnson in the office is really nice too. You know, this is someone who, you know, as much as I tend to think of, you know, Paul Ryan as kind of like a younger speaker, a fresher face, you know, the P90X guy, you know, the past, you know, handful of these guys had been in office for, you know, within spitting distance of 20 years, you know, 17 to 20 years before they become speaker. And even the relatively fresh-faced Paul Ryan, that was true in terms of his tenure in Congress. He had the Ryan Murray bill under his belt. So he had negotiated a major piece of legislation with the Senate. And we see Johnson's as a real divergence from this. So he comes into office in 2017. A big difference from the, you know, 17 to 20 years-ish range of the previous Republican speakers or just speakers generally in office. And we've seen his first attempt at legislating be a combination of Israel aid with cuts to the IRS, which the CBO quickly identified was not in fact a savings, since the IRS is the agency that collects the money. I think that learning curve will be very interesting to watch, as well as, you know, your kind of description of the man versus the office, as well as, like, you know, trying to suss out, you know, where someone, when somebody is negotiating things, a process that can often be kind of opaque. Let me make sure that I'm inserting some good news to our congressional podcast. Congress has passed the NDAA. Woot woot. Doing a little dance over here. I've got some jazz hands. It seems like there's been a number of different agreements, whether that's, you know, passing a CR to avert a shutdown at the absolute 11th hour, or the NDAA, where you had a number of different negotiators and different folks in Congress back away from provisions at the last minute that were always going to sink a bill. You know, how should we, you know, how normal is this for the NDAA?
I think this is somewhat normal for the NDAA, but with everything else that's going on, there's also some changes that we're seeing with House Republicans. Typically, the original House version of the NDAA is pretty bipartisan. There's been this sort of long-standing belief among Democrats and Republicans in Congress, but especially on the Armed Services Committees in both chambers, that defense policy is something that is sort of bigger than politics. It's supposed to rise above the partisan infighting and the sort of, you know, efforts for fundraising and things like that. And they really need to just take a sort of pragmatic, almost non-political look at this legislation. Obviously, there's going to be disagreements between the parties about, industrial base, excuse me, and other sort of big picture issues with defense, right? There are sort of different governing philosophies between Republicans and Democrats overall about this, but in general, the bigger political stuff that doesn't really have a lot to do with defense policy, shipbuilding, things like that, stays out of it. That is not really what House Republicans did with their original bill. But like you said, the conference version kicked all the partisan stuff out and said, we're not doing this. And so that actually is sort of a good example, potentially heading towards these appropriations bills, of how you can successfully conference when you have divided control of Congress. And so, but we did also hear a lot from conservative House Republicans, particularly members of the Freedom Caucus, during debate on that final NDAA conference report about how they were really furious with leadership and they don't want to see this happen again. And so, once again, the politics are coming back into this, and Johnson is going to have a lot of complicated decisions to make of how annoyed he wants Freedom Caucus members and conservative Republicans to be with his leadership. Or whether he wants to keep them happy and not get legislation through a Democratic-controlled Senate or signed by a Democratic president, right? And so this is one of those things with Congress where, whether it's NDAA or appropriations bills or any other legislation, they really have to decide if they want to play the politics or if they want to have a legislative outcome. They want to make law. And I think that's something we're seeing Congress increasingly move away from. I know there's all these people who have cited that, the number of bills that have become law is extremely low compared to previous Congresses. And that is something they're going to have to decide in 2024, heading to these elections, of what they want to say about their leadership and about their goals and about what it means to be a lawmaker. Do you want to send someone to Congress, either the House or the Senate, who is going to be pragmatic and is going to get as much legislation that benefits their district or their state to the president's desk and signed into law? Or do voters, are voters more shifting to wanting lawmakers who go on, their favorite evening cable news program or an Instagram or, Twitter Live and just say things, right? Like, what do we expect from members of Congress? And I think in the past few years, we've seen that really shift away from wanting people to make deals to wanting people to just sort of regurgitate the talking points and fundraise and have a majority, but maybe not necessarily do a lot with that majority. And NDAA is one example of this, but there's potentially going to be dozens of other examples of this in the next year where we get a sense of, does Speaker Johnson want to work with McConnell, Schumer, and Biden to make law and to, affect not only domestic policy, but military policy and foreign relations policy? Or does he just want to fundraise as much as possible and do what, the conservative members of the Freedom Caucus want to see done?
Yeah, absolutely. And while the NDAA did get passed, it's got a l much longer history of regular history of getting passed than other authorizations bill, real outlier in that regard. Which is always the context that you want to give for the NDAA. And the final bill passed overwhelmingly. That felt normal, even though this was a more embattled cycle than most. I love your distinction between politics and policy here, because you're seeing a lot of members of Congress putting forth things that are they can't possibly be passed into law, as kind of opening bids on different measures. So it's kind of the opposite of log rolling, where historically you all get a little bit of something that you want. There are going forward on zero sum policy wins, that there aren't the votes for. And I loved a couple of other things that you highlighted about the NDAA, which I want to bring us into kind of our final segment of just how unusual 2023 was. So first of all, and you know, I think we can just both add to this list. You identified that there was a conference committee, cha-cha, for the NDAA. You know, that by it, that's there's been exactly one of them this year. That was it. Now I do want to highlight that there were exactly zero last year. But this is kind of a if we're looking at different markers for congressional function, you know, this is one way of looking at that. The alternative to a conference committee, of course, is to have bills ping pong between the House and the Senate until either chamber can pass what the other chamber has done in an up or down fashion. And, you know, we've had, you know, kind of 15 and under, kind of roughly speaking, conference committees, you know, since the 110th Congress. So we've seen kind of a sharp decline in more modern times, and we're at the kind of extreme low end of that now. So, you know, not kind of part of a larger trend, an unusual part of a larger trend, I think I would characterize that as. So that's my first one. What was unprecedented or unusual about this Congress for you?
I think the amount of time I spent trying to figure out who was going to be Speaker of the House.
Yep. That's a good one.
I think from sort of a reporter perspective, I think we knew there was going to be a bit of a slog in January when McCarthy was trying to become Speaker. I think that went a little bit longer than most of us expected, or at least that I expected. And then we knew there was sort of single member motion to vacate, and we knew any member of sort of that conservative bloc could go to the floor and offer that at any point in time. And I think like when Florida Republican Matt Gaetz finally did that, I think a lot of us were like, okay, you know, what's going to happen here? Are Democrats going to vote present? Is McCarthy going to sort of rerun for speaker and get it? And you know, what's going to happen? And then I think I was really sort of, you know, after House Republicans behind closed doors voted for Scalise to be their speaker nominee, I thought, you know, okay, they're gonna need a few days to sort of like get everybody on the same page, but like, all right, we're gonna move forward. It'll probably be in like another 2 or 3 days. And then like he didn't have the votes for the floor and he like almost immediately bowed out.
Right.
And I think that is the point where I went, oh my gosh, we could be here for months. Like it's not like McCarthy was very firm before that he's not running again. Scalise got the nomination and then didn't have the votes and didn't even take it to the floor. It just
Right.
said, I don't have the votes. I'm not going to try to do this. And then I really thought, oh goodness, like this could last into the new year. Like if they can't agree on McCarthy or Scalise, who's it going to be? And then Jordan was nominated and Jordan had a few unsuccessful floor votes and then he bowed out and then it was Emmer for like 3 hours or something as the nominee, but he never took it to a floor vote. And then it
And
was
all these guys have
Johnson.
to continue to work together. Sorry for the fast interjection, but gosh, that's tough.
Yeah. And then it was Johnson. And I think all of us were just like, Mike, who? Like,
Including
what?
Susan Collins.
Yeah, I mean, and all of us were just trying to run around and like find other members from Louisiana or who had worked with him on committees or anything like that and just figure out who he was. And that's, I think, at the sort of the level you get when someone's running for Speaker of the US House, they're not as unknown as he was. And so we're seeing all these journalists and investigative teams still, you know, what is his financial disclosure? I'm sorry, he doesn't own any stocks, any retirement account. Like there's all these stories that keep coming out where you're like, that can't be right. And there's so many of these instances where we're just learning about the Speaker of the US House in real time as you have the Russian war in Ukraine and funding on the line for that, as you have the terrorist attacks on Israel and the ground war in Gaza and everything else that's going on. With the Israeli government right now, like you have all of this sort of China and Taiwan foreign policy and military policy playing out in real time. And now they're trying to negotiate this massive immigration deal, which Congress has not done anything with border policy and immigration in decades to this scale. And then they need to do the dozen appropriations bills. And now he's speaker heading into a midterm election for the House and a presidential election year. So he's going to have those dynamics and those politics, weaving their way into any legislation he tries to bring to the floor or get to Biden. And it's just wild to me that this is where we are. And then you sort of look at 2024 and you're like, I have absolutely no idea where we're going to end at this point next year, like zero idea.
Well, and there's so much of the whole speakership fight that was unprecedented, and if not unprecedented, then at least certainly unusual. It's the first motion to vacate that's ever been successful. First time we've had multiple ballots more than once in 1 year to elect a speaker. We had a McHenry stepping in there as the temporary guy after a provision that was inserted after 9/11. And so literally everything he did was unprecedented. So it was a new
And
unprecedented job. But I wanted to highlight something that you said because in terms of trying to looking at the personal politics of this and what these people are like, because I think that you can be a longtime Congress watcher, whether you're someone who just reads a lot of news or you're a scholar or you're whatever. And this was one of these things where there are aspects of this process that played out where I saw my journalist friends have kind of a better, thumb on the pulse of this in terms of what to look for because they knew these people personally. So folks who knew that Gates and McCarthy had a grudge,
loathe each other.
were looking to see how that would play out. I guess, I think the extent, while I think people know that from January, I think the extent to which that's true is something that my journalist friends had a better pulse on. I think it's really common to think of Jim Jordan as a kind of a gadfly to the system in terms of trying to push the legislative process as an outsider. So the extent to which he has long harbored the desire to be in House party leadership and to be speaker, I think was something that my journalist friends, really had like their finger on the pulse of that in a way that, even people who, pay attention to a lot of congressional news, were surprised by. I think, this whole episode, kind of brings home the importance of excellent reporting like yours.
Thank you.
All right, let's do a lightning round. One or two other, things that were unusual about this Congress. You do one, I'll do one.
10 weeks of straight session.
Yeah.
They hate that. We hate that. Everybody hates that. It was wild. It happened.
And what I'll add to that is we had the most number of rules, failed this year. We had four different rules, and sometimes that was just people expressing crankiness for a bill that had just passed. But that's another aspect of governing volatility and a lack of control by, House party leadership. So two of those is the defense spending bill. But we also saw folks in June vote down a rule on gas stoves after the debt ceiling fight. Say, I'm really cranky, and this is how I want to tell you about it. So, with that, I was actually joking to friends the other night that, the Taylor Swift like 22 song was actually like probably Congress's for this year. We had 22 bills passed, 22 days without a speaker. Four rules failed this year is 2 plus 2. The last time that happened was 2002. And now that I'm making a Taylor Swift reference, I'm doing the cringiest thing possible, which is to quote her like the senators like to. So I want to thank you so much for your time. I think this is a kind of a great way to cap off the year and think about where we are going forward for 2024. It's been a wild ride, and we will continue to follow your work as we're looking forward into the new year.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Always good to have you.